internet. Welcome to episode 4 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit of everything. With me is my glorious co-host, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
Glorious. I like that. It's almost like I deserve a medal for podcasting or something. Yeah, man, I was there.
You do deserve a medal for podcasting. Do you know how long you've been doing this crap? We are like podcast veterans.
You've been doing this for a decade. I've been doing this for, what, 4 years, maybe?
Yeah, we've been doing podcasts longer than most of the people listening to us. So, you know what? That's worth something.
Well, all right, then. So, today, as we record this, is tax day. In general terms, because I don't need to know your income, how did you survive the annual bloodletting?
I have no idea because my wife makes all the huge money and we have an attorney.
So
the attorney does all that. So that does give a little bit away on my income level. Also, I live comfortably in Massachusetts. That should say something as well. Is an expensive state.
Well, you're a stay-at-home dad, and that is important. So the point that I was leading up to here is that while a lot of people are really happy to get a tax refund from the government because, woohoo, the government is giving me money back, what you need to realize is that money was an interest-free loan that you gave the government. And when has the government ever done anything interest-free for you? So if that's the case, you should probably increase your withholding so that you aren't giving them money. On the other hand, no one likes to give money to the government either. And that leads us to a little bit of a sales pitch here, where I mention that Operation Blazing Sword is a 501c3 tax-deductible charity, so anything you give to us can be written off on your taxes. And wouldn't you rather give your money to a charity you believe in, rather than giving it to the government to spend as it sees fit? So while it's too late to do anything for 2017, for 2018, I'd like to encourage you to find that sweet spot where you neither owe the government nor the government gives you money. You're aiming for zero. And do that by donating to Operation Blazing Sword so that you have to pay the government less or nothing at all.
I think that's a great idea, Aaron. It's a great cause.
Thank you. So speaking of governments.
Oh, yeah. Let's get right into the topic here. I had to talk about this. So those who've listened to the Gunblog Variety Cast might have heard a while back. I can't even remember which episode it is. I could look it up, but I'm not going to. But I actually did a weird audio fisk on the old podcast. I covered a segment where they were talking about cracking down on knife crime in England. And I phrased it as I was calling from the future. Sean helped me do a whole bunch of audio effects that made it sound really funky, like I was talking across the time rift that I was calling for the future. And it was actually President Bernie Sanders was the Lich King and had declared martial law on the United States. I was rather proud of that one. But talking about the fact that England's still got violent crime problems, yet they've crack down on all the guns, and now they're going after the knives. And now it's London specifically. And actually, I really haven't read that much into it because I've seen all I need to see, really. I don't know if it's just increased police tension, because really, almost everything is, I mean, regular old men have gone to prison for carrying Swiss Army knives. Like, not even like a proper knife. Like, I mean, I carry a flipper folder like every damn day, every place where it's legal, which in the United States is most places. And I like flippers because they deploy well. And also that flipper, when it comes out on the other side, it's kind of a knuckle guard. So if push comes to shove, I don't consider them fighting knives. But if I needed to fight with that knife, that flipper is going to help keep my hand sliding down the blade. And I'm not going to get those OJ cuts that you might have seen if you watched the OJ trial.
So just to give you an idea of where England is in terms of how far down the loony hole, very recently there was a homeowner. I want to say he was in his late 70s, early 80s. Let's just say he was an old man living in a place called Hither Green. And a much younger man broke into his home to burgle it and encountered the homeowner, beat the homeowner, injured him. But during the scuffle, the homeowner was able to acquire a knife of some sort.
It was a screwdriver. It was the screwdriver that the guy had used to break into his house.
Okay. All right. Even better. First of all, not even a knife, a screwdriver. And secondly, it was the weapon that the perpetrator used, was trying to use against him, and he killed the burglar. Now, in America, that would be just the ultimate case of self-defense. It was a justifiable homicide. The police write it up and go home.
Can I add one more fact to this that I think is extremely important? Is not only was this old man at this, you know, apartment in Hither Green, but also his equally elderly wife was also in the apartment at the time. So on top of the, am I getting rid of this guy? But if this guy gets through me, he might do horrible things to my wife.
Exactly. And so while Americans would just say, yeah, perpetic coming, sleep well, sir. First of all, the man was arrested, and arrest has different definitions in Britain, but they brought him down to the station for questioning. And second, this is where things get really crazy. Outside his home, there is now a shrine to the dead burglar slash assailant, and people are leaving wreaths. They are not just memorializing his death, but they are lauding him. Someone who assaulted a pensioner. What the actual is going on here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was charged with murder. So he did face charges, and I believe, okay, now you're putting me on the spot here, but I believe they dropped the charges after, like, the entire nation of England also said what the actual.
Yeah, I get the feeling whoever was doing the prosecution looked at this and said, no, no way. But yeah, I mean, this is what formerly Great Britain has devolved to.
Also, to be fair, there was a not recent, I think this might have even been in like the, you know, the 20th century, but a gentleman had been mugged multiple times on, I can't remember if it was his way home from work, but it was a path that he regularly walked. And I'm spitballing here. I might have some of the information wrong, but he started taking to carrying an empty milk bottle with him on his walk. And so when someone jumped out of the bushes and tried to mug him, he drove the milk bottle into the dude's head. And he was charged with assault because it was not an improvised weapon. It was a weapon he had with him. It was a milk bottle, but he was carrying the milk bottle for the express purpose of bashing someone's head in.
Yes.
So I think this case also steps aside that because he stabbed the other man with a screwdriver, not a knife, didn't shoot him, didn't have a machete, didn't pull out his K-bar, wasn't like Michael Caine in, what was that movie, where Michael Caine was the ex-special forces guy that went on a revenge mission.
Yeah. I have no idea.
Give me 2 seconds. This. I need to Google this.
Okay, while you're looking, you may find this interesting. So Michael Caine's first, his real name is not actually Michael Caine. I don't remember what it is, but that's a stage name. And he got that name because he was talking on the telephone to his agent who was offering a part, and the agent wanted to know how he wanted to be billed. And he looked around and he saw the newspaper, and the newspaper had, I think it was an advertisement for, well, either it was an advertisement for the movie The Caine Mutiny, or maybe he saw the book The Caine Mutiny or something like that. But anyway, he looked at that, and that's where he got the name. And he says, there's a 50% chance that I could have been known as Michael Mutiny.
By the way, his full name is Maurice Joseph Mickleworth Jr. Which, I, knowing Michael Caine, he could have made that cool. And the movie that I was thinking of is Harry Brown. I highly recommend it. It's kind of a UK Death Wish, but he's a pensioner. He gets in a bad neighborhood that gets increasingly worse, and he gets jumped by a mugger, and he pulls out a bayonet and ices the guy. So that's how that works.
Okay, so wrestling this back on topic like a sled dog here. From what I understand, of the UK laws, obviously I am not a lawyer, but if you carry anything in preparation to use it, that is premeditation. So if the guy had just seen the bottle lying there and had picked it up and used it, that would have been fine. But the fact that he was carrying it made it a weapon, and that was forbidden, and that has to be punished.
Yeah, and I also think that's why this pensioner got off, not only because this is a horribly unpopular case, because, oh my God, like, I mean, Massa Yub could write like 13 blog posts on this, probably could write a book on this. The dude had, it was a screwdriver. It wasn't even his screwdriver. It was the other guy's screwdriver.
Mm-hmm. But this just points to a greater cancer within Great Britain. So they've effectively banned guns. I know that there are all sorts of exemptions. If you're hunting and you keep it in a safe and you allow the police to climb up your rear end and things like that. But effectively, no one has guns for self-defense. And now they're cracking down on knives.
They've been cracking down on knives. Now they're doubling down because the whole key point by this is London now has a higher murder rate than New York City, which, as far as I know, has never been the case. So there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when, you know, England and London and New York City had essentially the same laws as far as guns and self-defense go, and London had a lower homicide rate.
So London outstripping New York in terms of homicide is actually worse because of, again, the way the laws are interpreted. You see, here in America, when someone is killed under strange circumstances, we list it as a homicide. In England, in the United Kingdom, it's only listed as a homicide when they have a conviction. Otherwise,
it's a death of
it. Yeah.
Or something like
that. So this isn't just unsolved. They're only talking about, they've only been able to convict more people of murder in London than in New York. Not in terms of just actual unsolved murders. Oh my God. Yeah. And so this crime in England is skyrocketing. And now they've started this. Okay. They've been cracking down on knives for a while, but now recently, within the past year or two, they've been doing that whole only cowards carry knives. And there are knife surrender bins featuring pictures of Cookie Monster, because when you think knives, you think Cookie Monster, right?
Because reasons.
Because reasons. I don't understand how they're getting away with this.
And so how they're cracking down, too, is there's no Fourth Amendment. Not only is there no Second Amendment in England, there's no Fourth Amendment. So cops just are searching people. And that's okay.
Well, yeah, they're doing stop and frisk.
Yeah, they did an anti-knife campaign a while back where it was a YouTube, like, choose your own adventure. I covered it on my blog, like, ages ago. I'll dig it up and put it in the show notes. But, like, half the time, like, I was choosing to bring you choose to bring a knife or not bring a knife. I was choosing to bring a knife, but I was also choosing to do what I normally do because I carry a knife. What do? Someone gets in my face, I go away. I leave them alone. I don't want to start any conflicts. I don't want any trouble. And they threw in a little MacGuffin on there is no matter what, if you've got the knife on you, a cop is going to come up with you and he's going to frisk you. And I talked to somebody I knew from England. I'm like, can they do that? They're like, yeah, of course they could do it. I'm like, I can't do that here.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah. And what are they coming up with, Aaron? Have you seen the pictures? The London police on their Twitter feed are proudly putting junk on the bunk photos. And they are ridding the world of butter knives. They are ridding the world of garden shears.
Of pliers. They
are ridding the world of pliers, of scissors, of shovels. Just...
yeah.
Screwdrivers, lots and lots of screwdrivers.
Yeah, so this has just become ridiculous. No, we passed ridiculous a while ago. Now we're on absurd, and I think we're digging straight into avant-garde, because now in England, what, you can't even buy cutlery unless you're 18, mm-hmm. including plastic knives.
Including butter knives.
Okay, yep, but butter knives are metal. But here's the thing. I've seen this, and maybe it was a troll post, I don't know, but I've seen this four plastic disposable knives. You know, the ones that break if you butter your bread too hard?
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but I wouldn't be surprised. So to tie this all back into why are two gun nuts from the United States talking about what they do in England? I don't care what they do. The bottom line is that these people did come for the guns and they succeeded, and violent crime didn't go down. It went up. And so what did they do? They went for the knives, and they're also going for sporting equipment. They're going for anything that could be used as a weapon because this doesn't work. But they're never going to admit it doesn't work. They're just going to double down.
And hey, acid attacks are on the rise in England. So pretty soon there's going to be a crackdown on all sorts of solvents, the kind that you
find. There actually is. There actually is. They're starting to do background checks for certain chemicals. Not joking. Not joking at all.
No, I believe you. That was a laugh of, I don't know what the proper term is, but... Yep. Hysteria, perhaps? Yeah. See, this is why we advocate not one step further, because once you let them take the guns, then they'll go for the knives and the household chemicals, then the hammers, then, oh, hey, neckties can be used. Neckties and pantyhose can be used in strangulation. That's a weapon. So we got to do background checks on those. It never ends. Look,
these are people that are never going to be happy, and these are people that are never going to say, hey, why don't we go after the violent people? Why don't we just take people that are being violent? That hands and feet, just the guy that goes out to the pub every evening and gets drunk and then ends up pounding someone's nose in. Why don't we just go after that guy and like make his life really tough? They won't do that.
So long, England. It was a nice run.
All right, let's go back to America. Last week we heard your interview with Connie and her introducing herself, but there was actually some foreign policy talk here.
Yes, indeed. In this week's segment of Washington in Plain English, Connie is going to talk about a very important appointment by Trump to a position of power. So as our embedded interpreter, boots on the ground there in Washington, D.C., well, there's just a lot of nonsense that is coming out of D.C. recently.
Oh, howdy.
So out of the many, many crazy things that have caught the media's attention, what has caught your eye?
I think the great untold story of this week is the appointment of John Bolton to be National Security Advisor starting the 9th of April. It's not that he's been appointed. There are a lot of people getting upset about that. But if you'll recall last fall, when the president released his national security policy, which is an annual document put out by the executive offices of the president, through his assistant for national security affairs, which was then, you know, General McMaster. One of the things he said is that economic security is national security. I was so happy to see that line. I could even get over not having written it for him, because it's something that we haven't talked about for a long time. And Ambassador Bolton understands economics. It's not his discipline, but he can think in those terms. And paired with him is Larry Kudlow as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. And Mr. Kudlow doesn't default to thinking in national security terms, but he is an economist who understands growth and who can think national security. And he and Ambassador Bolton first came up together during the Reagan administration. And I think that this pairing of two advisors who are very strongly economic growth oriented and who have the ability to not shy away from the fact that we have a military and that sometimes the best diplomacy is an assertive diplomacy so that influence can be brought to bear now before weapons of war have to be brought to bear. I think that this is really the great untold story of the week, especially now that things have gotten so dicey with North Korea and China has been pushing us with trade and with their air identification defense zone in the South China Sea. When we were on the Carson advisory team, Dad and I had to figure out, how can we get the economists and the generals to talk the same language? And I wrote a little piece I call A Taxonomy of National Power, because the economy and our military force and our moral force, the extent to which people like us and want to be like us, they want to emulate us, these are the elements of our national power, all working together. Everybody sees the military. You put enough lead downrange and everybody pays attention. You know, the kinetic draws the eye. But what people don't see is not just how all that lead got there to be put downrange in the first place, but how by building relationships among people, giving them incentives to interact with each other, right? And by living our values, we actually create a body of influence that prevents us from having to go to the military solution as much.
So economics is warfare.
Well, if you think of it in the Chinese terms, my friend Dean Chung just put out a book called Cyber Dragon. He's one of the China analysts with the Heritage Foundation. The People's Republic of China would view this all as part of what they call information operations. Although to them, information operations is a much vaster subject. But that portion of information operations, which is the cultivation of influence and relationships, that's what a lot of what this is about. And I like to say that as we grow our economy, as we make our military ready, and as we behave in a way that is in line with our values, we develop force. And the old maxim is force in, power out. So we are rebuilding force here. What I see with Ambassador Bolton's appointment, in conjunction with Larry Kudlow's appointment, is that the president has an eye for rebuilding our economic force and rebuilding our influence so that he has a greater panoply of options with which to face the world. And I think that's healthy for us. We've been at war, what now, about 15 years? That's a long time. Our men and women in uniform are tired. I think they'd appreciate the president having options to use other than them.
So it sounds to me, just to summarize all of this, that by appointing John Bolton to this position, the United States is poised to...
We're poised to once again recognize and use an assertive diplomacy as part of our spectrum or array of tools for addressing problems in our relationships between nations.
Perfect.
And I have to make full disclosure here. I know people who have worked with Ambassador Bolton. They all think very highly of him in a professional way. And so my opinion of him is really shaped from their view of him as that they've given me over a number of years.
Thank you, Connie. You've given us quite a lot to think about here, and I look forward to hearing more from you as you attempt to decipher for us Washingtonese into English.
Thanks, Aaron.
I am so glad that we have a Washington insider talking on the show. It's so good.
It is, yeah. Man, if there's anything that ever needed to be translated into plain English, it is Washingtonese.
Especially all these appointments and other positions. Like, it's one of those, I get my senator, like, I vote for him or don't vote for them in the case of my senators. But they come up for election. We do all that. They do their thing. We get how it works. They do their votes. Actually, I don't fully understand how all the procedural votes work and all the committee stuff. That's a little confusing for me. But the floor stuff, I get all that. But then when it comes to just all these appointments and different subcommittees and groups like that, like it's good to have that translated for me.
So speaking of translation, I understand that there are a lot of people who are wondering why there's a cryptocurrency segment on a Second Amendment podcast.
That's right. Yet some of you spoken. We have listened. Savage has listened. But Savage is going to dive into more of the reasons why cryptocurrencies might be more of an interest to the American firearm owner.
So last week, I had just uploaded my segment on cryptocurrency, and Weird had listened to it, and he brought up a very good point to me. He said, "Savage, you know, you sure have been doing a great job educating everyone on what cryptocurrency is and what you're supposed to do with it, but you haven't really talked about why cryptocurrency is important." So this made me pause and think, and I know this week I was hinting that I would talk about how to secure your cryptocurrency and keep it safe and where to store it. But I've had about 2/3 of a Pabst Blue Ribbon, and I'm feeling a little bit philosophical today. So before I start out, let's go ahead and hit that disclaimer. I am not a financial expert. I'm not an expert in cryptocurrency. I am just a guy who has been educating himself on the subject as much as he can, and I'm relaying my thoughts and opinions. Do not take any of this as professional financial advice. I am not responsible for any decisions you may make. Your money is your personal responsibility. I just have some ideas on how to make it grow. So this week we'll talk about why is cryptocurrency important. And this will pander to my somewhat libertarian leanings, even though I sometimes might be a little bit left of that. So why is cryptocurrency important? There's a lot of reasons that come to mind, but the most important reason that I can possibly think of is that it takes away the power of wealth from the people who control it. For hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, money has been centrally controlled by governments, by tyrants, by organizations, and by companies. And it's been extremely hard to grow individual people's wealth unless you were able to come up with an amazing idea, such as an invention or some kind of intellectual property like a song or a movie. But since Bitcoin has come out and the concept of cryptocurrency has gained a foothold in the public lexicon, the concept has been growing and expanding at a logarithmic rate. It's just been absolutely exploding. And what cryptocurrencies do is they give direct access to a source of wealth that people have not had in the history of the world. And that is what is so absolutely exciting about it. For example, right now, you could have the ability to buy in to an initial coin offering that would give you a rate of something worth less than a penny at the time you purchase it. And by the time that initial coin offering comes to fruition, you could have already made 10 times the amount in which you put in. Now, I know that's an extreme example, and that doesn't usually happen, but the possibility is there. And the great thing about a lot of these cryptocurrencies and coins is that it doesn't matter when you get in, over a period of time, unless they're a scam, they actually tend to grow, and you'll at least be able to not only get your money back, but probably get a little bit on top of it. So because cryptocurrency takes that central power away from those governments, the despots, the companies, the organizations, and gives it to the entire world, the entire world has access to these. So it can't be controlled. Or at least it can't be controlled in the way that most governments would like to control it. And because of that freedom of access, the freedom of immediacy, the ability to transfer something as easily as if you're sending an email, it completely circumvents the needs for banks. In today's world, if you want to use a traditional bank, like using an ACH transfer, for example, if I wanted to send $600 from my bank account to a friend's bank account in India, it's going to take 5 days plus a $5 or more fee on top of that in order to send that chunk of change. However, if I wanted to use some form of cryptocurrency, let's say it's either Bitcoin or Litecoin or Ethereum, all I need is his address. I type in the amount of the cryptocurrency that I want to send, and within generally 20 minutes, it's already been sent, and he has complete access to use it in whatever way he wants. And the only way a bank actually plays a part in that entire process is if he wants to withdraw that cryptocurrency into cash. But back to the centralized control. This is something that makes certain nations wealthy or extremely poor. I mean, you look at the United States, and we as a country have become extremely wealthy because of the power of the dollar. It has become the world reserve currency. Everybody uses that as a medium of exchange when it comes to trade in the world. So that is, as the U.S.'s, I guess you'd call it, analog currency, it serves a very important purpose in the world we live in. Other countries, like several African countries, have had to inflate their currencies so much that they basically turn them into completely worthless pieces of paper, where $1 billion of one currency might buy you a loaf of bread, which is just insane. Another reason why countries are able to centrally control these currencies that they issue, like the US dollar or a Zimbabwe dollar or a Mexican peso, is they're able to inflate that currency to devalue it. And it's like an endless printing press. You need more money, they print out more money. You need more money, they print out more money. And over time, the value of that money goes down. That's called inflation. And so if you had a dollar back in the early 1900s, it's obviously worth a lot less now than it was back then. However, the design behind most cryptocurrencies is deflationary, whereas an inflation-based currency decreases in value over time, a deflationary-based currency increases in value over time. And essentially why the cryptocurrency's value will inherently increase over time is because most of them that are based on a deflationary method have a fixed amount of coins. Take Bitcoin, for example. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins issued. Once it gets to a certain point, that's the cap, that's it, that's all there will ever be. But with a dollar, there's no limit. You know, our government keeps on printing and printing and printing, and it just keeps going and going and going and devaluing and devaluing and devaluing. And if you're working off an inflationary system, if your salary is tied to that, your salary will go up as the currency is inflating, but you won't be gaining any more wealth. You'll be making the same value as you had always made, ideally. So in the end, you're really losing value over time. Whereas, say if you were paid in another cryptocurrency, over the same period of time, you will have seen that value grow. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not always roses, sunshines, and rainbows and unicorns when it comes to cryptocurrency. We saw that between December of 2017 and right now, which is April of 2018. There was a pretty big crash, and Bitcoin, which was up at $20,000 at one point, has crashed all the way down. It bottomed out somewhere around $6,500 and has now started its climb back up. As of now, it's hovering right around the $8,000 mark, and it pulls the rest of the cryptocurrency world with it. Wherever Bitcoin goes, so goes the rest of the cryptocurrency world. So it's volatile. That volatility is an advantage and a disadvantage when it comes to building wealth. So if you were to look at the stock market over the last 100 years, you would see a very steady climb, and people would be able to make, if you were using some kind of investment company, you'd probably be able to make somewhere around 15 to 18% a year on your investment. And while that's a great way and a safe way to build value in your savings over time, it doesn't really compare to cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrencies can swing 15 to 18% in a day. And that's what's so interesting to people, is because they can make in a day what they would normally make in a year if they were using an investment company like Fidelity or TIAA Cref or so on and so forth. But you also, again, have the ability to lose that much amount. But regardless of the amount of swing that the market will have in cryptocurrencies, the overall trend has been decidedly up. And it's not to say that going down and dipping is a bad thing, because if you are involved in trading, you can bet against a cryptocurrency that you think is going to fall, and if it goes down, you will make money on it. And then once it bottoms out, you can put more fiat in on the bet that it's going to go up, and then you can make money on the way up. So even though volatility isn't considered a very good thing in most markets, when it comes to cryptocurrency, it's very exciting because you can always make money both ways if you're a savvy investor. Or if you're a patient person, you can always just HODL, that's hold, hold on for dear life, for those of you who aren't familiar with nomenclature. And over time, even though it will go up and down, it will generally still go in that upward direction. So like any other money-making venture, cryptocurrency has its share of scams, and that's something that is definitely a legitimate danger that you need to be aware of. Now, the government has come down on a few different companies. You might have heard of BitConnect! Yeah, they got hosed. That was a pyramid money-making scheme, and they ended up just totally being wiped out at the end and taking a whole lot of money from a bunch of people and skipping town. So there is something to be said for government coming in and closing down fraudulent agencies. So I really do have to reiterate that when it comes to cryptocurrencies, it is literally the Wild West out there. But because it is the Wild West, because there is no holds barred, because there is a gold mine of opportunity out there in the Wild West, that gives you, the average person, the ability to venture into that crazy unknown territory and possibly make the kind of fortune and wealth that you've always been wanting to make. So as long as you're able to remember that there is great risk, there is also great rewards. So whenever you decide to put your money on the line, always make sure that it is an amount of money that you are willing to part with and never see again. But in the same token, it's an amount of money that can grow into something that can help pay for things that you need, like bills, a house, a car, vacations, whatever. You need to educate yourself on each and every cryptocurrency that you will be getting involved in, because if you don't pay attention, again, there's nobody who's going to come and pull you out of the fire there. This is all on you. And it, like I said in my disclaimer, it's your money and your responsibility. And as long as you're responsible about the amount and where you invest it, you could end up a great winner and come out on top. And that's what I really hope for everybody out there listening to me. I want you to come out on top of this new exciting world that is being introduced to us right before our eyes. So just be willing to get out there, dip your toes in the water, put a little money here and there, and see where it goes. But most of all, enjoy the ride. So that's all I got for now. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Savage Segment, and I look forward to talking to you next week, again, about how to secure your cryptocurrencies.
So I think that should be a little bit clearer for everybody. Like, this is, it's all about freedom.
Yeah, cryptocurrencies interest me, but I have no interest in doing them in pretty much exactly the same way that I love watching the shows on Discovery Channel about the people in Alaska who go off the grid and do everything the hard way. I'm glad there are people who do it. I find it fascinating. But I would never, ever do it myself, because I like my comfort and my internet connection a bit too much.
I like the grocery store. Grocery stores are awesome.
Yeah, but cryptocurrency is exactly the same way. While I would never use it because it seems like a massive pain in the rear, I am glad that there is an option, and I'm glad that there are people who do it.
And let's for cryptocurrency, like, you could do all this stuff in your jammies, so there might be a good chance that, like, at some point Savage is going to get me going, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get some of this stuff.
So last week, Weird Fist Shannon Watts. And much like a fungal infection, she's back again.
This time it's part two, where she focuses exclusively on arming of teachers.
Here is part two of my weird audio fisk of Shannon Watts of Moms Demand Action, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated on NPR's 1A podcast. A podcast run on government grants, named after the First Amendment, and as you'll be hearing now, directly assaulting the Second Amendment. So for this half of the interview, Ms. Watts focuses on the issue of allowing teachers in schools to lawfully carry firearms for their own personal protection and the protection of their students.
The idea that we are continuing to ask teachers and students to stand up to gunmen because some lawmakers are afraid to stand up to the gun lobby is absurd and really repulsive.
The absurdity is that we're supplying virtually no security for schools in this country and mandating that lawful citizens who otherwise safely carry firearms in their day-to-day lives not carry their guns in school. Or even when commuting to school, unless the state has a law allowing firearms in parking lots. We know from journals and testimony, as well as FBI data, that spree killers target gun-free zones. So the idea that Michael Bloomberg's anti-gun organizations not only oppose lawful carry in schools, but are also against additional security or increasing armed resource officers is the real absurdity.
Trained police have a hit rate of about 27% of shooting a moving target.
So what? We aren't saying teachers are cops or have to do any coply duties. We could speculate why police have such poor hit rates. And you could Google your local police qualification course or Google New York police trigger. But in the end, teachers aren't cops and we aren't making them cops. A school shooting defense is simply to bunker down in the classroom and cover the door with a firearm or firearms. If a killer breaches the door, shoot them. If it's the police, drop the gun and cooperate. And again, these killers target schools because they know nobody is armed until they hear sirens. In the schools that do allow lawful concealed carry on campus or allow teachers to be armed, there have been zero school shootings. Now that's far from conclusive evidence. But it dovetails well with the evidence that shows that most defensive gun uses end with zero shots being fired, and of spree killers often taking their own lives once they encounter any sort of resistance.
So the idea that we're going to arm teachers and make them sharpshooters is absurd.
It really is absurd, because you're making a straw man argument. We're not talking about guns on campus to fight crime or stop terrorism or fend off an alien invasion. We're talking about guns on campus to stop schools from being soft targets. And again, most of these spree killers kill themselves as soon as they face any opposition. No need to be a sharpshooter. The only important thing is to have people other than the killer armed.
And the vast majority of teachers do not want to be armed.
Cool. This isn't conscription. This is 100% voluntary. If you don't want to be armed, don't carry a gun. I'm curious where Ms. Watts gets her numbers, as the teachers who carry guns in schools that allow it aren't likely to be advertising that they're armed. And who knows what the question was? She seems to be implying that if campus carry passes, every teacher will be issued a rifle, whether they want one or not.
This is part of the gun lobby's effort to put guns everywhere. There's a reason they're trying to pass guns in K through 12 schools, and it's not because the data shows it's effective. It's because they are trying to open up a gun sale market.
Not effective? The FBI study shows that the bulk of spree killers target gun-free zones. We have journal entries and testimony that the killers were concerned about police and citizens shooting back. We also have schools where teachers and staff may carry if possible, and there have been no shootings there. The NRA wants guns everywhere because gun-free zones are magnets for predators.
Ultimately, you are making that choice for my children as well. And if you are armed and not trained and a volunteer, the idea that you would protect my children as opposed to causing more chaos for the police or making a shooting a more dangerous situation is unlikely.
Yep. Better to just lay on the floor like every town employee Colin Goddard and simply wait patiently to be shot. That worked out great. Better to bunker down in your classroom and wait for police to come help you. Oh, and the police are hiding behind their cars in the parking lot where it's safe. You can preach these platitudes, but your corporate anti-gun lobby is pushing these failed policies on my children too. All of these mass killings are happening in gun-free zones. And the corporate anti-gun lobby is demanding more gun-free zones.
The reality is, if more guns and fewer gun laws made us safer, we would be the safest country in the world.
Newsflash! We are. All these platitudes about how dangerous America is always comes with a caveat.
And in fact, we have the highest rate of gun violence of any developed nation. We have 25 times the gun homicide rate of any peer country.
We're not more dangerous than the whole world, just other developed countries. And developed country is simply defined as nations that have lower violent crime than the United States. Russia is a member of the G8 Forum, but isn't included in the list because it has a massive violent crime problem, including gun crime, despite having insanely strict gun control laws. Same with Mexico, Brazil, India, and South Africa. They're all considered developed nations. But hey, they don't count because they are excellent examples of how poorly gun control laws work for public safety. Also, it's not like the modern gun control philosophy is ancient history. Prior to World War II, most of the Western world had similar gun laws. The United States had a higher violent crime rate than, say, England or Canada even back then. We have our reasons why the United States has an elevated amount of violent crime, and it isn't our gun laws.
So this experiment that the gun lobby has done on America to have 300 million guns and very few gun laws is an abject failure.
Again, if our very few gun laws are such a failure, why do all these events happen where guns are banned? You aren't setting the variables for the experiment properly. See, the control group are parts of America that respect the Second Amendment and don't see this kind of violence. And the study group is the parts of the country where the corporate anti-gun lobby has had a field day with the laws. And there's blood on the ground, and you're marching in protest through it.
Teachers don't go to school to be sharpshooters, and students don't go to school to learn how to duck and cover.
Again with the sharpshooters crap. We've covered that. As for duck and cover, which is actually the name of a Cold War nuke drill, Shannon, you're thinking of shelter-in-place drills. It's a safety drill. And yes, this is one of those things kids do go to school for. We can argue if it's appropriate, but if we're having fire drills, then having an active shooter drill isn't any more uncalled for.
There's no data that shows that arming teachers will in any way stop mass shootings.
Except for the data that mass shooters don't like places where others could be armed. Except for how spree shooters often take their own lives when confronted with armed resistance. Except that there have been no spree killers in schools that have allowed guns on campus. Funny, no matter how much data you show her, she'll never admit she's wrong. Michael Bloomberg pays her too much. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
So much on just the loaded straw man arguments, and so much on the, oh, we're going to give teachers guns and they're going to do horrible things.
One thing that I find interesting is that so many anti-gun people think we are trying to force guns into their hands. And I don't understand how they think that, because, look, if you don't want a gun, I don't want you to have it. You are the wrong person to have it. No, I don't want you to have it. And I don't understand why they think that's the case, why we are trying to forcibly convert them. But I think, like with so many of anti-gun tactics, it's all projection. Because that's what they want to do to us. They want to take our guns away, even though we don't want it, even though we aren't hurting anyone. And so, because they want to do something to us, they assume we want to do our version of our thing to them.
Yeah. And the bottom line is, these creeps go after gun-free zones intentionally. So let's stop making them gun-free zones. We don't need to have everybody armed. They don't need to be Navy SEALs or Army Rangers. There just needs to be the question of whether there's a gun. There doesn't even need to be a gun in the school. There might be, every single person in there might be someone who's like, no, I'm uncomfortable carrying a gun. And fine, don't carry a gun. But because they can, that is the deterrent factor that I think is missing in all these spree shootings.
You know, I actually have a t-shirt for sale that quotes me, and it says, concealed carry is herd immunity against crime.
So true. Now it's that time again for our house dick. Steve's got another story to tell us, and this one's a really interesting one, and it might be a little bit surprising what the subject is.
Welcome back, everybody, to Tales from the Trunk, Episode 2. Are you guys ready for another story? Great. Hope you enjoy it. Let me tell you about the time that I became the subject of an investigation. Now, back in 2010 or so, I'd been working as a private investigator for about a decade at that point, and I'd settled in doing insurance fraud work for a rather large company that shall remain nameless. Now, that's the kind of stuff that you hear about on TV. You know, the big, evil, faceless insurance company has doubts about Billy Bob Smith and the validity of his injury. My job was to determine objectively whether he was as messed up as he claims he is. I have no skin in the game. My job was just to observe and report. You know, the kind of stuff I'm talking about. Guy gets caught, re-roofing his house or playing softball, that sort of thing, all by his lonesome after screwing up his back working at the plant. Now, insurance companies, as everybody knows, has things like red flags. Most industries, in fact, do in order to determine risk. We also do assessments of those who are legitimately injured and perform status checks to make sure that they were receiving their benefits in a timely fashion. Well, it was late February, early March, and we were going through a seasonal thaw, and I had a recorded statement of an individual at their place of employment to check on their recovery and any further prognoses regarding their injury and return to things like full duty and the like. Now, as I stepped out of my car in the parking lot of Big Mammoth Corporation, I slipped on some black ice. My world, of course, flashed before my eyes, and before I knew it, the wind was knocked out of me, and I was flat on my back, spread-eagled in a parking lot. I heard a pop on the way down, and I knew the sound as I had experienced it in high school. I had just torn the ACL on my one good leg. I managed to get to my feet, brush myself off, and finish the interview. I did put in a phone call to my office, however, to inform them of the on-the-job injury. Now, so, generally, I became a workers' compensation statistic. I went and saw my doctor, and was assessed for reconstructive surgery a few weeks later. Of course, the damage was to my right knee. My driving leg was, of course, immobilized, and I was to be off the road recovering for several weeks post-surgery. As it turns out, I was a few weeks out post-surgery, late in the spring, when a buddy of mine from the office called. As we worked with each other occasionally, you know, I picked up the phone to chat and see how things were. What he told me happened to shock me. He said, "Hey, Steve, you aren't going to believe this, but I need you to step outside." I asked him why, and he said very flatly that my own employer had sent out one of my coworkers, my good friend, approximately 3.5 weeks post-surgery to see if I was either A, a liar, or B, trying to get out of working for the obviously reduced wage amount that comes with workers' compensation. So, I did what any smug son of a gun would do. I stepped out on the porch, hobbling on my crutches, looked right at my buddy's surveillance rig, which was parked a few houses up the street, smiled, and waved at him. I'm still good friends with this man to this very day, and we often get together to share stories about the field, and I would have him cover my six any day. I mean, we, after all, do work in Detroit on a regular basis. Now, of course, I was shocked and dismayed that my employer at the time would have so little trust in its employees, and my distrust was, of course, reaffirmed a few more times in short orders for stories for other days, but I didn't stick with that particular firm for much longer. I've heard from other sources within the company that, well, if anyone knew how to cheat the system, it'd be someone like us. And I can't say that I blame them. We do know how the system works, but I have no desire to cheat the system, as it were. I enjoy my job, and things being as they are, it wouldn't have helped me to stay on the injured disabled list any longer than I did. So, hopefully, this story can relate to perhaps a few of you out there listening in podcast land. Generally, if we're out and we're watching you, we have reason to believe you're not being as honest and forthright as you claim to be. So straighten up, fly right, and you won't see somebody like me lurking in your rearview mirror. So, as always, remember to feed and water your favorite neighborhood trunk monkey. Donations of ammo and cash are, of course, welcome at ACP. So you guys have a great one.
Wow, his second segment, and he has already hit his stride. Wow. Steve is just a natural storyteller, and from what I've heard, he's got a lot more like this that are as good or better. I really can't wait to see what he brings us next week.
Yeah, and that's... I remember on the Squirrel Report, Jay one time was talking about his father being a private investigator, and I said, oh yeah, no, I really wanted to be a private investigator. He goes, you know what they do, right? Yeah, it's a lot of slip and fall people and people faking injuries. That stuff's interesting. See? It's interesting. Thanks to all for listening. Be sure to check out our Facebook page. We also have a Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast. Members will get additional podcast content and members-only opportunities. Also, Patreons get access on Friday when the podcast normally drops on Monday. You can hear more from me on my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And on the Handgun Radio podcast on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can find me at my nerd blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, my prepping blog, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, and if you're interested in making a tax-deductible donation to Operation Blazing Sword, go to blazingsword.org.
Hear more from Savage1R on the We Like Shooting podcast on the Firearms Radio Network. And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He's Weirdy. I'm Pony. Together, we're an Anatine Equine Extravaganza.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.